Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of your End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
Tim Phillips.
Welcome back, Dark Tower Boys.
Mm-hmm. That's the masterpiece of the summer so far.
hey, we'll get there. We'll get there. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and you can find us here in our, well, soon-to-be end of temporary summer home. Thursdays at 10 a.m. We're going to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week is the new romantic comedy, The Big Sick. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to look back at the last few months at the movie theater and talk about the best of the summer. And it may not seem like it, but there were some good movies too, right? Right?
Yeah. Like The Dark Tower was a good one.
All right, Tim, since you're so confident about The Dark Tower being one of the best, why don't you tell us what one of the better movies of summer was?
I put together top three movies of the summer. Number three on my list is The Big Sick, which we're going to be talking about later, so I won't delve too deep into that one. But I thought held together well as a film, had some nice comedic moments. It was like your classic Apatow-type film, even though he didn't direct it. He produced it, but he definitely has a signature even with movies he produces.
Oh, for sure, like Superbad.
Yeah, Superbad. So, like, heartwarming yet still, you know, that off-kilter humor as well. So
I'll add to The Big Sick saying that, you know, it's easy to stand. I mean, not nothing against the movie, but it's easy to stand out when, you know, you can't really remember any other comedy this summer that you either wanted to see or that, you know, you left the theater thinking, oh, this was a great comedy. It's kind of hard. I haven't seen Girls Trip, mm-hmm. but that is supposed to be very good. I think it's that and The Big Sick in terms of summer comedies. Mm-hmm. Peter, you're number three.
I haven't like been loving the summer so much. but like Big Sick would be my number one too. Guardians of the Galaxy, I think, was really early summer, right? Guardians of the Galaxy was pretty great. It was, like, it wasn't special, but it was Chris Pratt. It was very comedic. And Kurt Russell, that's I love seeing him in it. And his character was really fascinating. And I know enough about the comics to have gotten some hints at what's up and coming. And I thought the little spoilers at the end were pretty great, too. But it was just a basic blockbuster. But on this summer, it was still one of my favorites.
Yeah, that was actually my number three, too. A lot of people have been asking, is it better than the first one?
And I thought 100% it's better than the first
really?
One. Yeah, I loved it.
I think the first one was kind of so fresh and original and like coming out in, you know, the pack of what Marvel had done before. It had its own flavor. It had its own tone. And because it took place in deep space as opposed to Earth, they could go off and do their own thing, even though that first movie did tie into the overall arc with Thanos and Infinity Stones and all that. But what I will say about the sequel is that it's, you know, it stands apart in so much as the first one stands apart.
Oh, yeah, you could just watch it by itself and still love it.
Yeah, and I think it does a really good job of developing the characters further. Star-Lord and Rocket in particular. Nebula, who was a villain in the first one, is kind of not a hero in the second one, but less of a villain. Kurt Russell was awesome. Sylvester Stallone was in it.
Yeah. He was in the first one too, wasn't he? Really, really briefly? Or was he just in the second one?
I think
he
was just in the second one.
Because that was pretty cool seeing him.
So, yeah, he's like one of the other Ravengers, one of the group of space pirates that Michael Rooker in that is so... That's
He's my favorite character in both of them.
Yeah, he's so great, Michael Rooker. And
he's funny, but I think they gave Drax maybe 10 too many jokes. He had like a joke per minute. They were the same thing, just kind of repeated. But other than that, it was good.
It speaks to Dave Bautista. Well, his species being highly literal, but it also speaks to Dave Bautista, who was kind of an X factor going into that first movie, coming from the pro wrestling world, and that's very hit and miss in terms of whether their wrestling talents translates to to something else. And that first movie, you know, he was a scene stealer. Mm-hmm. And so I think they kind of overcompensated. Like, well, clearly Dave Bautista is capable of doing more heavy lifting than we think he's capable of. Mm-hmm. And kind of played into that in part two. Did you see Guardians of the Galaxy 2?
No.
No?
I haven't seen it.
You saw the first one, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys like the second better than the first one, you're saying?
I liked it better than the second one. They're both fantastic.
Yeah. I think they're both good. I think just because the first one has had a bit of more freshness to it. I think the second one, James Gunn was given more leeway, and I think that worked in some ways or didn't work in other ways. But
his brother Sean Gunn gets like a decently major role in the sequel too,
right.
Though, and I love him. I'm a Gilmore Girls fan, and it's great seeing him in it. And he's just funny, even if you don't like Gilmore Girls or
Sean Gunn's
work.
Girls.
Yeah,
Sean Gunn is James Gunn's Clint Howard.
Yeah.
One of the things I will say about Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is that I think what we see in the Marvel movies is that when you get to the second one. There's kind of a comfort level. There's kind of a, like, we know what we can do and we're not going to stretch ourselves further. You know, we saw that with Iron Man 2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Thor 2. The only one that kind of, Avengers 2 as well, the only one that kind of breaks the mold is the Winter Soldier, Captain America 2.
Both the Captain America films are a bit different. More drama, not as much comedy as the other ones.
Right, but you know, the Winter Soldier though grew the mythology. It didn't kind of rerun the same event. I mean, it could have been very easily to like Captain America going to like let me tell you about what happened in 1996, and then go back in time, and then do another World War II adventure. That would have been the easy way out rather than to do something that was kind of a bit bolder than the Winter Soldier.
What they did was needed though to lead on to the next upcoming Marvel films.
That too.
I like the second Iron Man, actually. I like the first one better, but I really like the second one, too. Mm-hmm. And I think it just shows, like, how much acting plays into even, like, these superhero movies. Mm-hmm. Like, just the presence of Robert Downey Jr. in those movies.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, like, this guy is owning this role. And, you know, in some of these, like, the Defenders we were talking about before the show.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we'll be talking about it later, but like I watched that, the episode one on Netflix, and it was like the actors who had the presence, I didn't really even care what hero or villain they were. You could tell like Sigourney Weaver, it's like, okay, she knows what she's doing here.
Mm-hmm.
She's playing this villain. She didn't really do a whole lot in the first episode. Nobody did anything in the first episode, but you can watch her and go, okay, she can really sink her teeth into this role kind of thing, you know, and not just be that bland.
I didn't know she's going to be in it. That's
fantastic. She's establishment. So just like having her there is like a seal of approval in a way.
Yeah.
But to go back to your broader point, the superhero, I mean, this has been a pretty good year, pretty good summer for the superhero movies,
which
is why kind of I think Guardians has, because that's why I put it on my list, is because I feel like it's kind of been forgotten.
Yeah, it has. And it was the first one.
Because you had Wonder Woman, and Wonder Woman was great. You had the Spider-Man movie. Spider-Man was great. And then on top of that, you have, you know, something like Logan that came out earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a really good year for superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Number two.
I put number two, Baby Driver.
Ah, yes.
We reviewed on this program.
I still got to see that.
And I enjoyed it immensely. It's just filled with cool car chases, like old school, what could come across as cliches by other directors, but Edgar Wright is really good at mixing it all in, having those awesome sequences, the, you know, bank robberies, car chases, stuff that you've seen in a million movies, but he puts his own spin on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a very interesting soundtrack as well.
Mm-hmm.
I know we reviewed Atomic Blonde on here, and it had a good soundtrack, but it was kind of obvious, those obvious 80s tunes, whereas his is very eclectic, which I thought was really cool. And it's was what the character was all about, was his music, because of his hearing issues and his trauma from the past. So it was cool seeing him move in his car. And also there's chase scenes on foot that was really cool as well. And I thought it was a really great action movie with some really interesting secondary characters as well.
So. Yeah, there's a great scene that isn't even about the action, where they're in the car and they get the Halloween mask out, and it's Mike Myers as Austin Powers, and it was supposed to be Michael Myers from Halloween, and they're arguing about it for like 5 minutes, and it's like, no, you mean the Jason? It's like, no, it's hilarious.
They wear a mask that's Mike Myers, or Mike Myers is in it?
No. They say, you need to go pick up Michael Myers masks.
Halloween. Mike Myers,
and they come with like Austin Powers masks.
How much comedy does it have? Because part of the reason I haven't seen it is, like, I love Edgar Wright, and, like, I don't know. It has, like, 100%. I was a bit disappointed he chose not to make a comedy, which is, that's not fair, but was there any comedy in it? Was there any laughs?
Yeah, there's some comedic moments, funny. Like the masks. Okay. And
I gotta see it.
Yeah. It's pretty funny. It's not like Hot Fuzz.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But which was definitely more comedy action, but I think the tone is very similar, with more going to the drama action side than the comedy side. Come to think of it, it's been 10 years this month that Hot Fuzz came out, too.
That's 10 years. 10 years since Superbad came out, too.
That's right.
Wow. Have to do a double feature on those. It'd be a fun double feature.
Hot Fuzz still stands up, and it's still hilarious and still got great action. So it shouldn't be that surprising that Edgar Wright can handle this. It is a bit surprising that people have finally discovered Edgar Wright.
I was surprised how much money it made, yeah.
Yeah, it's been made a lot of money for him and for the studio. So I hope that means he gets a little bit more leeway and a little bit more freedom in choosing his next project. I hope maybe it forces people to go back and revisit something like Hot Fuzz or Scott Pilgrim, especially Scott Pilgrim, which still confounds me to this day how that wasn't a hit. But... Such as it is, but
it's a cult hit now at this point.
And that's fair. And some may argue it's better to be a cult hit and live forever and be a huge hit for a couple of months like Avatar and then kind of fade away. But I mean, that's maybe a discussion for another day.
I think the Avatar sequel comes out 2018 though.
Well, they say. I'll believe it when I'm in the seat. Forget the trailer. I will believe it when I buy the ticket and go into the theater and sit down and wait for the curtain to raise.
Avatar was pretty awesome, though.
I haven't seen it since it came out.
I thought it was great when I saw it when it came out. And I was actually disappointed that The Hurt Locker won Best Picture.
Really?
In my mind, I think that movie's overrated. But that's just my mind. I just felt like it was...
I don't think I've seen either of them since I saw them the first time, but you might be right.
I thought her Zero Dark Thirty was overrated, but I liked Hurt Locker.
Zero Dark Thirty was overrated, but it was still good. I thought it was good, but it's definitely overrated.
Yeah. But Avatar, I thought was really good. But yeah, I guess you don't really go back and watch it. No. It doesn't seem to be a movie that people go back and revisit.
We talked about Titanic last week. Not the three of us, but Jenna and Ian who are here. And that's something that people do revisit. I'm not sure who revisits Avatar. It pops up on TV occasionally, but it's...
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason it booms so much, though, is because of its visuals and the 3D, right? And so many other films still do that. So it's not really as special as it was.
So. Anyway, speaking of special, you're number two, Peter.
There was a lot of films I loved before summer, but if we're talking just about summer, just like another superhero film, like Wonder Woman was one of my favorites. It was nice. It was great.
Yeah.
But it wasn't very special or anything. I'm not a huge like stereotypical blockbuster guy. Wonder Woman was good though, and I think it was needed to have a specific like female superhero film because there hasn't really been anything of that nature. And I hadn't seen her in anything else. I hadn't seen any of the other DC films, and she was fantastic at it.
Yeah. Gal Gadot. I think it's Gadot, not Gadot. I think we had that debate when we reviewed it. But anyway. But yeah, she was really great, and she was kind of one of those things, like, can she carry the movie on her own? Because she was in Batman v Superman, but she had like a kind
briefly
of small
near the
role
end,
in that. But she was in the couple of the Fast and Furious movies, and she was good because she was like evasive ninja chick kind of thing. And the weight of expectation on that movie was incredible, and the fact that it was able to not just carry it, but to be a huge success and to really energize the public. And
I was glad how much money I was expecting it to get, like 30%, like all the other DC films. So that's why I went to see it. I had no plan until I noticed how well it was doing, and the trailers look good. I like that it was set in the past. Yeah. That was good. It didn't have any connection to the other DC ones, so they could focus on the storyline and the character. And I'm not a DC fan. I don't read the comics. So it was cool seeing what Wonder Woman's background is like, what the Amazonians were up to, what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I think it was a long time coming for a Wonder Woman blockbuster movie, too. So that probably contributed to the box office as well, right? Because you don't have that fatigue from there have been being movies 3 years ago about Wonder Woman. That was like the big blockbuster.
And that's the thing is apparently behind the scenes, they've been sweating for years about what the reaction to it was. Was it going to make a lot of money? And I think, you know, and we talked about this when we did review Wonder Woman. It's like, well, look at the how much money something like Lucy made, or what's that other one? Jennifer Lawrence, Hunger Games, the Hunger Games movies made, and like the Hunger Games movies are basically superhero movies. Like she's basically a superhero in that movie. She's Hawkeye because she has a bow and arrow. Yeah. But so I think that it's a terribly kept secret how much of a desire there is for female action heroes. And it seems to be something, and I hope that Wonder Woman kind of finally breaks the mold, but like every couple of years something like a Wonder Woman happens. Like, oh, women want to see women kick butt too, and men like to see women kick butt. Interesting. And then it kind of goes into the back of somebody's mind for several years until another one of these movies comes out. So, I mean, will it encourage more Wonder Women or more Atomic Blondes or more?
I think so.
You know, it's well, yeah, and that I hope so, but I think that remains to be seen.
I saw a movie poster the other day for Proud Mary.
Right.
It looks like a blaxploitation film. And
yeah, that's Taraji P. Henson.
Right. Yeah. So. Who's that looks like? I'm thinking back to like Jackie Brown after that came out. Okay, now there's going to be all these female black, you know, blaxploitation films, and that was the only one, really, right?
Yeah. That's well. And then that starred Pam Grier, who was in blaxploitation films. It was. I was going to say Foxy Cleopatra, but that was Beyonce in the Austin Powers movie.
The best Austin Powers movie. Anything with Beyonce, man.
That's why the summer hasn't been.
Yeah, not enough Beyonce.
Not enough Beyonce.
She had a baby, so she had other things to do.
I just want to say about Wonder Woman, Spud from Trainspotting is in it. And he's like one of the central characters. And Trainspotting 2 didn't do so well, so I was very happy to see him making a good amount of money because I think he deserves that.
Yeah, and there was the, I can't remember his name off the top of my head and I hate myself for it, but the guy who played the chief, who's an Alberta actor.
Yeah.
And he's an actual indigenous actor. So it was a big year for him too. And I know there was a story on the news where he was like at a movie theater in Alberta, like in his hometown after a screening. And he was like, yeah, obviously the biggest thing in that movie is the chief. So, yeah, so that was...
The
casting was great. I agree. I chose a documentary from a number two, which is on Netflix right now. It's called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. And, of course, I speak to my, you know, my other life doing political stuff. And it's a really... I think it's very... It goes deeper into what the sort of the concerns are with media and the press and coverage right now and beyond the fake news and people calling real news fake news and that debate. It's about the Gawker case, Hulk Hogan, who sued Gawker for releasing part of a sex tape he was in. And, of course, it turned out Hulk Hogan was being backed by a man named Peter Thiel, who's a Silicon Valley billionaire who was mad at Gawker because they outed him as being gay a few years ago. So this was kind of like revenge. So they bankrupt Gawker for revenge, and it wasn't Hulk Hogan paying the legal bills. It was this billionaire. And then, of course, there's a side story in it about how Sheldon Adelson is a very famous Las Vegas billionaire. He owns a lot of casinos, bought the Las Vegas Review, the Las Vegas Journal, which is the biggest newspaper in Las Vegas, and he kind of did it secretly. There was all this talk about the journal being sold and nobody knew who it was, and then they were worried it was Adelson. And yes, it was Adelson, and you know, not the billionaires can't own papers. Certainly Jeff Bezos owns The Washington Post, for example. But Sheldon Adelson is also, in one hand, buying the press, and on the other hand, he's like a mega donor to a lot of Republicans. So that's, I mean, it's a very good movie in terms of breaking down these very complicated legal and economic issues. And yeah, it's something that gets lost in the debate, I think, that we worry about fake news, but you know what? Who's running the news? Who's controlling the news? And someone who owns their own news site like I do, you know, to think that, you know, there's a billionaire who might have a vendetta against me. I mean, it's unlikely to happen to me, but you never know. it's entirely possible with deep pockets, you know, might not like something I write, and you know, I do not have that deep of pockets myself. So,
right, yeah,
it's a kind of a wake up call, I would hope.
Yeah, well, you look at like Fox News and Rupert Murdoch, and yeah, there's so much right wing media in the States.
Yeah,
that's controlled by people. You don't. And then they talk about the liberal media elite, and they've talked about it for years, and it's hard to really find those people who are controlling it the way, like, the right wing so,
yeah,
well, you know, so viciously is, in a way, you know, like Steve Bannon with his site, too, right?
Yeah, and St. Clair Broadcasting, that's kind of something that's going on. It's not getting too much attention that, you know, they're producing these segments that are defending Trump. A former Trump campaign advisor is doing these little commentary segments defending Donald Trump, and they have like this thing called Terror Alert Desk where they amplify these terror concerns, and they give them to the local news stations to say, you have to run these. And so people tend to trust their local news more than the big national news, and so, you know, people are kind of getting propagandized without them knowing it. And, you know, so that's nobody speak doesn't get into that, but I mean, that's, it's part of the issue too.
So do they interview Hulk Hogan and Peter Thiel?
Yeah. Do you get to watch some clips from that?
They have clips from the trial. But I mean, probably for obvious reasons, Hulk Hogan and those people don't really sit down for sit down interviews. It's the, you know, the people who are affected by it. The CEO of Gawker, who's, you know, fighting personal bankruptcy now, is, you know, he sits down. But, you know, it shouldn't be too surprising that Hulk Hogan doesn't want to go beyond the curtain to...
He can be as nice and generous as you can possibly be in those kinds of videos.
Yeah.
So if anyone listening wants to watch it, he's a generous, nice, and full-hearted man in that video. I don't know much about Hulk Hogan.
You mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, he certainly wasn't nice to Cocker. He took them for like $300 million.
Yeah.
You're number one, Tim.
My number one is one we reviewed first show together, us three. It was Maudie.
Number one
movie of the summer, because it officially was released in the United States in June. I think it came out before then, like it was out in April and it was at TIFF last year. But I think we're talking about movies that stick with you afterwards. This movie stuck with me for a couple days afterwards.
Oh,
I thought it was quite an emotional experience, and it's something you about the painter Maudie Lewis, who had physical ailments and lived in this little shack with her husband Everett Lewis, who sort of talked her into being his housemaid, but then she ended up doing these, you know, populist paintings, these these great, you know, landscapes and flowers and stuff in Nova Scotia, which is a Canadian story, which is really cool as well. It was directed by an Irish woman, Aisling Walsh, but it was written by Canadian Sherry White. And I think it was really interesting showing that story, even though it was filmed in Newfoundland because they couldn't afford to film in Nova Scotia. Sort of showing the Canadian side of things, and then also just seeing these characters, kind of like the Big Sick in a way, but deeper, right? It's based on a real relationship.
And just the two in the relationship.
Yeah, and there's just those two in that relationship, very isolated from the rest of the world. And Sally Hawkins is amazing in it. I thought she deserved an Oscar for Happy Go Lucky, Mike Leigh's movie, back a while ago.
I enjoy her in that, yeah.
I think she'll get a nomination.
I think she deserves at least a nomination for this.
Yeah.
And it'll give the movie some publicity, which will be really cool, too. Yeah.
You know who else I like from Happy Go Lucky? Eddie Marsden.
He's amazing.
He's so good. Enraha! It's hilarious.
And he's following her around and stuff.
Yeah.
That guy was creepy.
But back to Maudie, I don't want to dismiss Ethan Hawke as well. Great performance by him.
Yeah, he's he's already got. Has he gotten an Oscar award? Do either of you know?
I don't think so. I think he's been nominated, but I don't think he's won.
That'd be cool if he got one.
Yeah.
He does a fine job. Like, it's a two-person show, so he's playing off her very well, I thought.
Yeah.
After reading about what the actual his character was like in real life, he was darn good at it. Mm-hmm. He's good at being a very grumpy but nice, very deeply nice, very deep in the heart, nice guy. But on the outside, very stone cold.
Very gruff and antisocial.
Yeah.
And,
You're number two.
It also, it came out in the winter, like early January, but it wasn't released until May in at least Guelph. And no one really remembers it or even knew about it or saw it. I was the only one in the theaters. Gold.
Oh, yeah.
With the Matthew McConaughey. I was partly glad, even gladder now that I've seen Dark Tower, because it was, I was thinking like, oh, no one's going to remember this. They're going to think this was his worst film of 2017. No, no. They'll probably in like 10 years look back at it in a positive way. And I loved it. It was just, it wasn't special, but it was fun.
It was no Dark Tower.
It was the Gold Tower.
It was more fun than Dark Tower. And he was a very heavy man, and he gained all the weight for it. So I respect him for that. Edgar Ramirez, who I've seen in a lot of other things, he was really great in it. And what it was based on is a very interesting story. And it was very central on just Matthew McConaughey and his wife, like Maudie. So it was really nice seeing that, getting a look into how billionaires deal with love and romance. I don't think I'll ever be able to understand that myself. I'll never be a billionaire or a millionaire. Corey Stoll was in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he was bald in this one. You never know, bald or full hair, like in Midnight in Paris. But he was bald, so I could tell. And he, as per usual, was really great in it.
I don't think his wig in Midnight in Paris was as bad as the one he wore first season of The Strain, though.
No, that's why I mentioned it. I didn't know he was wearing a wig or that he was Corey Stoll until I checked the Wikipedia after watching Midnight in Paris. So I'm glad he wasn't wearing a wig in this. It was nice seeing him.
Yeah.
And just it was just fun. It was fun. All the characters were well written. It was all filmed in Thailand, so there's some great shots. The cinematographer is the one who did it for There Will Be Blood. So if you're a visual man, just go see it for that. You can even turn on mute, put on some music. You get a good glimpse of Matthew McConaughey and some
fill in the story
good
yourself,
visuals.
Yeah,
exactly.
All right. Yeah. my number one is something I just saw this past weekend, actually, Logan Lucky, which is the new Steven Soderbergh. And it's kind of like a Hillbilly Ocean's 11 or, you know, maybe Sweet Home Alabama meets Ocean's 11. It's Channing Tatum and Adam Driver and Riley Coe as siblings, and they plan a heist. They plan to rob the NASCAR, the vault under the North Carolina. I can't remember where in North Carolina, but they have this racetrack there that they do NASCAR at, and they're going to rob the biggest race of the year. They're going to take all the money that is sent down these pneumatic tubes from the concession stand to the vault, and they're going to rob it and stick it to the man kind of thing. And it's all about how this family has an apparent curse on them because Channing Tatum was a football hero who blew out his knee, so he's now like working stiff, blue collar guy who can't really hang on to a job because it's not because he's bad, but because you know the landscape out there for blue collar people isn't great. His brother, played by Adam Driver, went to Iraq twice, lost his. Everybody says you lost your arm. He's like, no, I lost my hand, and so because he lost his hand and part of his arm. So there's this feeling that the family is cursed. And they go to this man named Joe Bang, played by Daniel Craig, to help them rob it. And Daniel Craig steals the show. It's not surprising to see him play a tough guy. It's not surprising to see him play imposing. But he was really funny in it, and that was a surprise and a treat. He was a real scene stealer in it. And so, it's just a lot of fun. I think it's non-glasses Steven Soderbergh. You know, if you know your Soderbergh, when you see him on set when he's all wearing glasses, you know it's super serious. When he's not wearing glasses, you know it's a bit more laid back. So it's kind of in that mold. And it was a lot of fun, and I think there's a lot of, you know, if you like Baby Driver, this is something you'll want to check out too, because it's a very unconventional action movie with lots of great characters. Yeah, it's if you saw Hell or High Water as well, mm-hmm. it's kind of like the funnier version of that. And there's some of the same themes playing in terms of, you know, the disenfranchised working man and the system screwing you and that kind of thing. So it's a lot of fun. And Daniel Craig is, I feel like he's back. I don't know if he went anywhere, but it's, I think this was a nice palate cleanser for him because, of course, it was announced this week that he is going to be back as James Bond in the next James Bond movie. Mm-hmm. So I think doing something like this kind of helps him get over the grumps, the post-James Bond grumps.
Something else, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, Bond. So he might feel a bit more looser now, so.
Yeah. Well, but he's glad going you back, like though. That, because that's like on my list of ones to watch. And
me too.
Steven yeah. Soderbergh coming out of retirement. Looks like he's having his 3-year retirement or whatever he had.
Hayao Miyazaki did that this year too, the Japanese director.
That's
so
right.
many people are doing that. So many older directors are just coming out, you know.
Well, not even older directors. You know, people like Kevin Smith's always talking about retiring from directing. And Quentin Tarantino says he has 2 films left. And it's like, who are you
also
trying?
Been talking mm-hmm. about Clerks 3 for the past 10 years.
He's been talking about Clerks 3 and Mallrats 2.
Well, Mallrats 2
hit somebody.
Apparently comes out late this year. He said that,
believe
so I'm
it
hoping.
When I see it. That's another one I'll believe when I'm sitting
yeah.
in the movie theater.
I've been trusting him for too long.
Yeah.
But I love you, Kevin Smith.
If you're listening,
when he's listening,
when he is, yeah,
he's too busy making 35 of his own podcast.
Yeah,
all right, we're gonna take a break here and then come back with a review of The Big Sick. And until then, we're gonna play a little bit of music from the band that you always tell strangers is your favorite brand, and that is Metric. And the song is Sick Muse, which I felt was very apropos. It's from their 2009 album Fantasies. And then we will come back with a review of The Big Sick. You're listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Now that the niceties are out of the way, I have to tell you that when you yelled at me, it really threw me off, and you really shouldn't heckle comedians. It's so rude.
I didn't heckle you. I just woo-hooed you. It was supportive.
Okay, that's a common misconception.
Uh-huh.
But yelling anything at a comedian is considered heckling. Heckling doesn't have to be negative.
So if I yelled out, like, "You're amazing in bed," that'd be a heckle?
Yeah, it would be an accurate heckle.
Cool.
Bye.
Oh.
Now you can.
I'm going.
You scared my friend off now.
That was a scene from The Big Sick, the new romantic comedy from Michael Showalter, and it stars Camille Nanjiani, Zoe Kazan, Holly Hunter, and Ray Romano, and it is based on the real-life love story of Camille Nanjiani, and it was written by him and his IRL in-real-life wife, Emily Gordon. And so this was Tim's number 3 movie of the summer. So we'll start with you, Tim, and I think you are eagerly anticipating getting to explain why it was your number 3.
Yes, it was my number 3 because I it was a strong comedy, and like we said earlier, they're sort of slim pickings for comedy this summer, and I like how it held together as, you know, in the... What I see is like a classic comedy in that there's heart, there's warmth to it, yet it's really funny at the same time. So I thought that was cool. I really liked a lot of the supporting characters, although I really like Kumail and I like Zoe Kazan as well in the leads, but I really liked Ray Romano. I thought he did an excellent job in a supporting role.
Yeah.
just doing little on the screen, but by doing little, his presence was there as the father, the understanding father throughout their whole ordeal. And I thought I did a great job showing two people, especially Kumail, chasing his dream to be a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting there because the stand-up comedy in the club actually wasn't that funny. And then I read afterwards that it was meant not to be that funny because otherwise all these people would be having one-hour specials at that point. But they were trying to make it in the comedy game in Chicago. So that was an interesting backstory.
They were young. They hadn't found their comedic style fully yet.
Yeah.
That's a great point is, I think we're probably all familiar with, seeing stand-up from stand-up specials, which of course is like the refined of the refined. It's like, this is the act. Mm-hmm. And, you don't see the years and months and weeks of shows and of people like testing out jokes and trying new material. And the most bizarre one was, what was her name? I wrote down her name. A.D. Bryant, who I gather from Saturday Night Live, but her stand-up act is she has like a visual, like an AV presentation where she has like visual aids.
Yeah.
And it's like having been a part of like displays at like shows and things. I don't understand how you go to a comedy show and you have to travel with your easel and your 11x17 graphics. It's a bit tough.
I would say Bo Burnham's jokes were funnier in the film than they are in real life, though. That's just my opinion.
I like his early YouTube videos. I watched them back in the day. I thought he was really really good with a parody song or two, but now he's kind of still milking it, I guess.
Yeah, well, he knows who likes him.
Yeah.
So he's making it for people, I think, who are a bit younger or a very specific type of comedy, which is his.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, well, aside from Bo Burnham, how did you like The Big Sick?
Oh, I thought The Big Sick was incredible. Everything about it. I thought it was maybe a slow burn of a buildup when it comes to the comedy.
Mm.
I didn't think in the first like 20 minutes there was enough laughs. I was getting a bit nervous because like I expected it to be, and it was like just a pure comedy. It's laugh after laugh. I was worried it would be more like a dramedy because there's been dramedy. There's been too many dramedies recently, and not enough just straight up comedies. Like the only really great pure comedy that made it to like the big, the theaters last year that I can think of is Why Him, right? Mm-hmm. With Bryan Cranston and James Franco. Nobody saw that. So I'm glad that The Big Sick is booming and it's hilarious. I love Michael Showalter, Michael vs. Michael, which got canceled after, I don't even think, a full season. I loved him in that. MTV's The State. And he did a great job directing it. I'm actually glad it wasn't Apatow they were able to get. It was him they gave the script to first. But I think Michael Showalter deserves this. And South by Southwest, I think, is where it first aired.
Yeah.
I believe. And it won best like fan favorite, which deserves. And like you said, and I'm glad you said it, man, Ray Romano. I loved him in the film so much. Although to be fair, everybody loves Raymond, right?
Everybody loves Raymond.
And it's his joke.
Yeah.
A giraffe walks into the bar and says, "Highball's on me." Like that's one line. That's one of his minor lines, and it's gold.
Yeah.
It uses his talents well because he's very dry, and this character was very dry as well. The humor of it was very dry, which appealed to me. I had to decide between playing the clip I did play, and I chose it because it had both Zoe Kazan and Kumail in it, and the other clip, which was available, and I was surprised, as when they're in the hospital cafeteria, and he's Ray Romano says, "So what do you think of 9/11?" And Kumail Nanjiani says, "Oh, it was a tragedy. We lost 19 of our best guys," and that it was so unexpected. The theater was laughing. Yeah. That I saw it at the Bookshelf, and it was a pretty full house, but good. The theater was still laughing at it 5 minutes after that joke because I think it was so unexpected and it was delivered so dryly and to the point, and he just nailed that reading so well.
It's a great time for this movie too, right? Given like and just how the Southern parents come to love the Muslim future son-in-law. I thought that worked quite well. Yeah. And they showed some racism in the comedy club, the heckler.
That's my favorite scene.
Go join ISIS, or, you know.
That was an awesome scene because it's what turns Holly Hunter's character, who plays Zoe Kazan's mother, because the guy's heckling him, like, go join ISIS. And she's like, oh, so you want ISIS to get more people? We have an ISIS recruiter here.
Yeah, she wears the pants in that family, man.
Yeah, yes,
like, Ray Romano's. She's wearing the pants for sure.
And it's such a great moment because until then she's been absolutely cold towards him. Not because she's racist, if you haven't seen the movie. It's because Khalil breaks up with Zoe Kazan just before she ends up in the hospital and ends up in a coma because of a virus she has, and they put her in a medically induced coma. So she's a bit cool to him because she obviously thinks her daughter's great, and she thinks he's an idiot because he purposely screwed up their relationship because he didn't want to tell his parents that he was dating and possibly in love with a white girl. Yeah. So that's a great moment that's both funny, hilarious, but it also is a great character moment as well.
Yeah, and the key element, too, is Kumail not wanting to tell his parents about this white woman because they're strict religious Muslims.
Yeah.
They want him to marry a Muslim woman through an arranged marriage.
Yeah, but they're modern, too. So it was good getting a glimpse into what arranged marriages are currently like, because it's a lot different because they just had a regular house and everything like that, but still were quite strict about arranged marriages. I don't know anyone that deals with that, so it was good getting a glimpse into how families do.
It was handled particularly well because it's both a culture that's unusual to us as three white guys here, but in the way it was phrased, and I made a note of that as watching the movie, in this very kind of family sitcom way, where he's going over for the family dinner, and they're eating dinner, and there's a knock at the door, and the mom goes, "I wonder who that is," and which is a very sitcom thing to do, and again, the way it works is you invite the girl over, you see if there's a spark, and then you go and make the arrangements. It's not so unusual from the old sitcom trope of, like, the doting mother trying to marry off the son or the daughter, and then, some having somebody drop by, a neighbor's son or daughter or a friend's son or daughter or something. So it translates in that regard as well. It's, again, being funny while being relatable.
Mm. His family was just comedic, too. His brother.
Awesome.
His brother was really funny. His brother's explanation of how he deals with the arranged marriage in that one scene is really funny.
Yeah. And the fact that the parents, after they disown him, give him Tupperware with food in it. And they're like, your mom can't see me hug you, so I can't hug you right now, So they're showing they still love him, but, like, it's like they've got this weird code they have to abide by,
Yeah.
It's what modern arranged marriage is like currently in North America, right? People always picture it the way it was, like, hundreds of years ago, right? But it's still around. It's still the main type of marriage. It's just, it's very different. And this is a good look into it.
Here's, you give me your daughter, I'll give you a field and a goat. That's not how it is.
No.
But yeah, it's that actor's name who plays the brother, Naveed Adil Akhtar. Him and Khalil. I keep messing up his name, Kumail. I don't know him from anything. It's not I know he's from Silicon Valley and things, but I'm not terribly familiar with him. So this is kind of like the first time I've kind of encountered him, and he was great. But Kumail and Adil Akhtar were the two cast members who were actually Pakistani in identity. So. He was really great. He was hilarious.
Not really stand up anymore though.
No.
Which is interesting.
But yeah, it's I love the scene at the end where Naveed's like there giving him feedback and glasses, and I guess he's like playing up the Hollywood he's like giving his brother like advice. Oh yeah, no, it was really, really good. It was hilarious. And the scene where they're at batting practice too was hilarious. Mm-hmm. They had really great chemistry, really believable sort of brother sibling dynamic, and the whole cast was great. Mm-hmm. Zoe Kazan, spends most of the movie in a sick bed or out of the picture. But what I found interesting was we have here a romantic comedy where one of the people realizes they're in love by the complete absence of the other person, which is an unusual way to go about this, but it's a fascinating fascinating approach that, you know, it's almost like he falls in love through her by kind of dating the parents and you know, being in their orbit and seeing her through them and getting to know them and you know, I guess knowing what it's like to become part of a different family aside from his own family, which you know, is pushing him one way. So that's kind of a fascinating angle too. But Zoe Kazan, the scene she was in, I thought she was great.
Yeah, I know she's really good.
Yeah, I know she's from Girls, which is another thing I haven't seen.
First season's really good.
Thank you, Peter. I think they made seven of them.
But
but yeah, she was really good. And speaking of Apatow, I think if he had directed this, he would have glossed it up by, you know, 25-50%, and he would have...
there would have been more comedy, probably would have been 20 minutes longer even.
There would have been... I mean, it's almost 2 hours as it is, but he would have glossed it up, and I don't think he would have cast Zoe Kazan as Emily either, which would have been a shame, because I think she was a delight, and really great chemistry between her and Camille as well.
He would have probably... Quirky. Sorry, go on.
Oh, Zoe Kazan. I thought she had very quirky, very interesting to watch, and she had great chemistry with Camille, who's playing himself. So she's playing the wife, which is probably an awkward and interesting situation.
I like how Kat just his regular name too. I like that.
There was there was a great scene where the bathroom scene where she's like frantically trying to find out where the to get over to the cafe because there's no matches in his bathrooms because she has to number two, and that's something you don't see in a lot of romantic comedy. It's like the moment you have to defecate in your significant other's bathroom for the first time.
I had a question about that scene. How did it really end? Because then all of a sudden they were just outside, so I'm like, they go somewhere or something?
I'm a lot like her. Especially if I'm at a guest house, I have trouble with that. Just turn on the tap, and then people won't be able to hear you. She should have just turned on that tap.
I think it was the...
The smell.
The odor, yes.
See, I worry about the sound. Oh, okay. I don't know how she dealt with it then.
Yeah. Because all of a sudden they're outside. It was cut to them outside.
Oh, yeah.
Sitting on the stoop explain it. Or whatever. Yeah.
I think he left the apartment as she did her business.
Extended edition. We'll be able to find out.
Deleted scene.
Hulk Hogan sex tape will be on there, too.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Just randomly.
I certainly hope not. The only kind of thing I think I had a problem with was it ended in a very kind of Hollywood romantic comedy sitcom way, and you know, there's certain tapes that are seen, and you know, where she kind of comes out of her coma, but she says it, you know, I remember, you know, what happened before I went into the coma, and I don't know everything you went through while I was in the coma. And there's a moment where she sort of sees his true feelings unfiltered, and that kind of felt sitcom-y. Although, from what I understand too, that this is more or less as it happens.
So. Oh yeah, yeah. I think Judd Apatow would have changed it. That's why I'm glad it wasn't him. He would have added some things, like you said, to make more blockbuster, and it would have taken away the truth, because it was written just by Kumail Nanjiani and his wife, right, Emily V. Gordon.
Yeah.
So maybe that is how she just came to New York and went to one of his stand-ups.
Well, I read about it afterwards, and actually they did take some liberties with the truth. They didn't break up before she was in the coma. They were still going out, and they got married shortly after that.
Okay. Right, those are some wise changes, though.
But the one thing that was true was his family didn't know about him dating her. He kept that secret from them during the relationship.
Yeah, I did check out the IMDb Tribune, and apparently that was a bit exaggerated, and that the mother was apparently initially upset because Emily was sick, but and then is when Emily got better, then she got mad at Camille. so that's a bit changed, but there are some things sort of added for obviously more dramatic tension, and unfortunately you can't argue with how it played out in real life, but it still felt a little false to me. But I mean, other than it didn't ruin the movie, I think it's still a really solid romantic comedy, and romantic comedies are really hard to do, mm-hmm. to do mm-hmm. well, and to make them have a voice, and to make them original, and to make it feel real. It's harder than you might think, and everybody I think on the show did a great job. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that it's real life or based on a real story only adds to it. I mean, it feels very believable on its own, even if you didn't know it was a real life romance.
Yeah, and it appeals to a wide base of people, and it's cool because you've got, you know, Muslims, people from the southern U.S., you've got mm-hmm. wide stand-up comedy milieu. It's kind of an interesting overall amalgamation there.
I did love the backstage stuff with, like, the comedians, like, kind of riffing off each other.
Yeah,
and who's up and who's down. And David Alan Greer is in and out as, you know, he pops out of his office long enough to introduce the next comic and goes back in. I think it's presumed he's doing drugs back there.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that it was Chicago too, because I read about this the other day. Bob Odenkirk was doing an interview, and a lot of people think all the funny stand-ups are from New York.
Yeah.
And that's not true. It's the Midwest, places like Chicago, and then they just moved to New York.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true.
So if anybody that's a stand-up for the Making Box or whatever is listening to this, move to Chicago, then move to New York.
Well, or Toronto, too.
They have Second
Toronto,
City
Chicago,
and
New
Chicago,
York.
Right? Second City, just like Toronto.
Oh,
yeah.
Chicago.
That's
really,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the original class of Second City was Chicago and mm-hmm. Toronto. I do believe they have branches all over now, but that's where Second City was originally, which was Chicago. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people from original Saturday Night Live came from Second City, Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Bill Murray.
Yeah.
John Belushi.
Right. And then a lot of people from SCTV, of course, came from Second City, Toronto. So, you're right about Chicago, and it was very shrewd to set it there, because it's, you know, it's believable. It's not New York, and it feels a bit more natural, let's say.
Yeah.
I liked he was an Uber driver, too. So they said it in the present, even though this probably took place like 15, 20 years ago. I'm not really sure when it took place, but it was set in the present, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, it probably took place like the 90s, way before that Uber.
Yeah.
I had trouble understanding it at first. I thought it was set when it happened, so I didn't know what his job was. I was like, what is this? Did he invent Uber? Like, oh, my goodness.
He's a billionaire. He's just doing it for fun.
But then I saw a smartphone. I was like, oh, okay. It's
But the Uber, though, does make sense, because if you're trying to stay available for doing comedy, because, you know, you sometimes get that last minute, you know, opening, you know, what are you going to do for paying the rent? Well, you're probably going to do something where you can have really super flexible time. So Uber makes sense. But great plug for Uber, though. Maybe not so great for Lyft. You know, maybe another movie can come out and somebody can be a Lyft driver to balance out the universe. I don't know.
In the sequel. He'll be a Lyft driver. He'll fall in hard times and become a Lyft driver.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. He gets fired from Silicon Valley or something.
Oh, I hope not Kumail.
No, I think Kumail's very, very safe. I think he's set. I think he's definitely... I hope this... I might go and watch Silicon Valley now.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Good.
Well, TJ Miller's in it too, and just a bunch
of
great
people. I know TJ Miller from, you know, Deadpool and being horribly killed in Transformers 4. But I think this will be a great stepping stone for him. And like I said, making romantic comedies are really, really hard, and this one really, really nails it, and is so fun, and I could see it again. Which is something you can't really say about a lot of romantic comedies. It's, you know, I'm sure there were some jokes, because like that 9/11 gag, like 5 minutes after, you're still laughing about it, and
I'm still currently laughing.
But you know, so there's probably some stuff you're missing when you're laughing. And then there was a scene where Ray Romano's at his apartment spending the night and talking about who gets laid at a math conference. And Kumail says, just because, like, flat math teachers. It's It's again, great movie. Anyway, we have to sort of wrap that up there. And if you want to listen to this again, it will be available on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. We are also on social media, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on the Twitter. Tim, where can people find you in this or any parallel universe or on the internet?
On the internet, Flash in the Deadpan. Check out website. Check me out on Twitter. I wanted to actually plug a short Canadian film called The Big Snit.
Big Snit.
It's an amazing movie. The Big Sick, the title reminded me of it. So The Big Snit, animated 1985, NFB. It's about a couple playing Scrabble when there's a nuclear war going on outside, which I think fits with these times. And actually The Simpsons in their second ever episode were inspired by that, to have a Scrabble game with Bart and the family.
Right, so, the one that they go see Marvin Monroe.
Yeah, and you can watch it for free on YouTube. It's The Big Snit, S-N-I-T. YouTube, it's less than 10 minutes, and it's really funny and sort of timely given today's circumstances.
Awesome. That was a short film. Awesome. I'll watch that for sure.
You, Peter.
Just Mr. Tarak. Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. Just type in Mr. Tarak on Google. You'll find something. But yeah, that's it.
Nothing to plug? Anyway, I will be back here later today for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And until next Thursday at 10 a.m.